accession number 19927, reel 3.
Major Dunning, reel 3.
Right, isolate the pull switch and then cut through the safety fuse, and then there's no problem. No, I've got some photographs somewhere of the, it's all recorded in the regimental history here, of the slabs of gun cotton. And then after Palestine, we went down to Egypt and came home. And then...
Just before we leave Palestine, any other incidents that happened to you there?
No, not really. I was there during one or two nasty incidents. No, the battalion wasn't involved in anything other than that. We did very monotonous guard duties and then some coastal patrols when they were landing or illegal immigrants and that, but a very frustrating period, really. I think all that same as must be in Ireland now, in Kosovo. You know, it's a duty which soldiers don't like but have to carry out, aid to the civil power in whatever form it comes, and especially when you're going trying to combat terrorists. You have to use a hell of a lot of people. I mean, we had the same problem in Cyprus later on.
What was the attitude of the population towards you?
Jerusalem, well, the Arabs, of course, we were, the Arabs favoured us tremendously. In Jewish settlements like Petah Tikva and places like that, they're sullen, I would say sullen. They really felt that Britain owed them a national home from the Balfour Declaration, and they resented any restrictions we placed on them. And of course that was fed and, by American propaganda, as it Ben Brex said, every time a soldier, British soldiers killed in Palestine, as a holiday in my heart, or words to that effect. And we didn't get much support from the British government, because at that time I think something like 160, 170 members of parliament were Jews. And it's interesting to reflect that of all the deeds of heroism, in which there were quite a lot, there's not one military award for service in Palestine. CNC's commendations and things like that, but not one MC or MM. I mean, we took part in that thing there, not one award. So that was Palestine.
Any other post-war situations you were in?
Well, I was in Korea as a staff officer, but...
What did that job involve?
Well, I was in 29 Brigade. We landed when the North Koreans were over... in an occupied Seoul, and we took part in the, we were there at the time of the Incheon landings, which forced the North Koreans back out of Seoul. And then I was, 29 Brigade was the first balance brigade. We had three infantry battalions, the famous ones at Gloucesters, and Royal Ulster Rifles, Northumberland Fusiliers, had our own tanks, flails, etc., and our own artillery. And then after the Incheon landing, we were to go up into Northern Korea, and I was on the advance party that went up to Pyongyang. And we got up there just before Christmas what year was that? 1950. And when the Chinese crossed the Yala River, and it started to snow there that night, and we had orders to withdraw back down to the parallel. So that was quite a memorable too, not so much for the fighting, but again for the misery of thousands of people either side of the parallel, going North Koreans, that they persecuted the South Koreans, they shot people out of hand. South Koreans took their pound of flesh by reciprocating. Very cruel, the Koreans. And I believe that the people who were Japanese prisoners of Japanese during the war always said that the Korean jailers were worse than the Japanese. Odd too, come to think of it, but when you think of Korea today, they seem to be, North Korea, of course, is a bit different. South Korean seem to be quite democratic, but when you see the way the police handle student riots, these streaks come out again. But unfortunately, my first wife had got leukemia, and at the Christmas, I was called back because she was suffering from leukemia. And so that was my limited experience of Korea.
What was, specifically was your staff officer job?
I was G3, was operations. The brigade major and I were responsible for operations of 29 Brigade. Interesting thing too, the brigade major, Ken Trevor, was an ex-commando. He commanded one commando in Burma, and we're great buddies today. It's odd that both the operations people should be ex-commandos. After I came back...
What were your main problems in your doing that job?
Well, planning for all brigade situations, whether they were in the line or on defence, the overall plan would be done by the operations brigadier, brigade major and myself. So that's why I went up to North Korea, because the brigade was going to be deployed up there as a recce, to recce a decent position north of Pyongyang, where the brigade to be deployed positions. It was quite a long way up, and there was no roads there. Had quite a hairy journey up to Northern Korea. No fighting up there. You got through quite easily. I think we would have been all right. I don't know what happened to the North Korean army. It just seemed to melt away. But then they came, when the Chinese, of course, came in, they were resuscitated and took part in the subsequent fighting, which had lost us, and 29 Brigade, of course, did extremely well. The famous Battle of the Yingjin, which one of my mates were captured and spent the best part of 18 months as captives of Chinese. In fact, one had been in Fourth Commando, Spike Pike. He'd been in C Troop, one of our great climbers too, and he was captured by the Chinese. I last saw him in Kaesong, which was south of Seoul. So after Korea, I was posted to Sandhurst on the staff there, and then went to Staff College, and then after Staff College out to Cyprus while the troubles were on, as a G operation staff officer. And
which brigade were you with there?
No, I was at GHQ, General Headquarters, Middle East Land Forces.
Where was that?
In Nicosia.
And who were you under there?
General, Cavalry Officer, not Dorney, he was a commandant at staff at Sandhurst. Keatley, General Keatley. I had an interesting job there. Just before, they were cutting down, obviously. The GHQ had come from the canal zone after they had been evacuated to Cyprus, and I joined them when they were in Cyprus. My job was going to be axed, cutting down. But just before it was, the General Keatley called me and he said, I want you to go round the Middle East, Field Marshal Templer. was just about, well, he wasn't Field Marshal, he's just about to take over Chief of the Imperial General Staff, and he's coming out here prior to being the CIGS designate, and I want you to go around with him, briefing him on the various places. So I had a very honoured job of going around with Field Marshal Templer. We went to Jordan, we visited Lub Pasha, inspected the Arab Legion, dined with King Hussein and the Man. King Hussein, incidentally, had been a cadet when I was at Sandhurst. We went down to the Gulf, Sheikhdans, Aden. We had came back to the Canal Zone and North Africa, Tripolitania, Cyrenaica, and Baghdad. And General Templer, I stayed in Baghdad, but he went up to visit the prince who was in charge while it still had monarchy in Iraq in those days, and went up to the hills there. And so that was a very interesting, very interesting visit.
What was he like to work for?
Our super chap, called a spade a spade. His speech was quite often like a trade union official, bloody this and effing that, and he liked to drop a gin, but never abused it. He liked to smoke his fags, and he had sort of deaf and dumb signal for me to ply him with cigarettes when he was running out, you know. He put his two fingers to his lips and go through smoking it, and I knew that he needed another packet of fags pretty quickly. But he was a gem to work with, gem to work with. One of the things that I remember about him, I used to give him, well, he had briefs to wherever we were going, of course, and then he'd call and he'd say, "Oh, why don't you give me the lowdown on this bloke, you know, none of this bloody sheet of foolscap stuff. Tell me what you really think of him and what you've heard about him." He liked the sort of shop floor information. But when he was reading a report, he was the first chap that I ever met who did that fast reading technique of reading down the centre of the page, and he'd go through pages. And I said to him, "How do you manage that?" He said, "Well, I look for important words, and just if there's something there that takes my mind." I mean, he said, "I always read the introduction and the last paragraph very thoroughly. And then if there's clues there, I go back. But I go sack down the centre of each page." Another important thing, wherever he went, what has hospitality, he always insisted that a written note be sent back to whoever, whether it was in the sergeant's mess or the officer's mess, that they personally thanked them. Just a few words, and that was a priority. Had that common touch. Great chap.
And what were you exactly doing for him?
Well, I was just his staff officer, you know. He had his aide-de-camp. But, for instance, when we were in Baghdad, obviously as being the operations and in the operations department at Middle East, I knew something about where the best information came from or who were the personalities involved, to brief him on that sort of thing. And when we went to Jordan to brief him on the Arab Legion, the personalities there, and how things have shaped up, and what, you know, was the GHQ opinion of Hussein. He regarded Hussein as an upstart. But, no, fair. I mean, Hussein was very pro-British, but he was being led astray by some very young Arab Legion officers who saw, every time they shaved in the morning, saw themselves as Egyptian dictator who took over.
Nasser.
Yes, Nasser. It's Colonel Nasser. And of course they did try to stage a coup after Glubb went. They got rid of Glubb, and then they tried, but unfortunately Hussein was able to put it down with the help of some law officers.
Which years were you working for Templer doing this job?
This was what, that would be 50, 57. And then my job was axed there. I was courting my present wife at the time. And so I was going to have to go back to the Hampshires, either in Germany or Far East. And at that particular time, the 16th Independent Para Brigade came out from England to go to Suez. And the brigadier had been at Staff College when I was there. And he saw me, he said, "What the hell?" Tubby Butler, a chap called Tubby Butler, brigadier, became a general in BAOR, corps commander. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm just about to go back to my regiment." And he said, "Do you want to go back?" I said, "Well, no, I'd rather stay here." And he said, "Well, we need a company commander and two para. How about it?" I said, "Yes, fine." And so I joined two para.
In Cyprus?
In Cyprus. And we went to Suez and then came back and chased Ayoka in the mountains.
Can you take me through Suez? Suez. Do you remember it?
Yes, it wasn't. Of course, the Suez operation was very controversial. I don't want to go into the background of that. It was an Anglo-French invasion, which...
No, don't go into the background. Just what you personally remember.
Yeah. Well, ironically enough, the main British forces there were the Commando Brigade, Royal Marines, and the 16th Independent Para Brigade. One battalion had dropped of para. Tragically, we didn't have enough aircraft, only for one battalion. They dropped and captured the airfield, and the other two battalions were to come in by sea. The 2nd Battalion was to come in by sea and go down to the bottom of Port Said, which started the Suez Canal itself proper, and then get down to Port Suez as quickly as possible. We landed without very much transport, so we were allowed to requisition trucks, which we did, and Coca-Cola lorries and things like that. And so by 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, we were ready to steam down. We started going down the canal zone. We got to a place called El Kantar when the halt signal the Russians had brought a lot of pressure to bear, and the Americans had brought, and we were told to halt. And we stayed there for a couple of days, being sniped by some odd Egyptian people. And then we were pulled out to go back to Cyprus to deal with Ayoka, which we did for the next 3 months.
Did your company suffer any casualties?
At Suez? No, none at Suez.
What company was it?
I had headquarter company there and then took over C company.
Can you tell me about the operations in Cyprus, please?
Right. I joined them prior to Suez, and we were in we took over Macarius Palace, the Bishop's Palace, in the centre of Nicosia. We carried out a few operations there after Suez, in the September, and we were mostly in the Kyrenia area, but they were quite small operations. Our main operations we carried out was up in the mountains over the period of December and January 57, and we were based at Plartres, and we had one battalion, one company who were trained to ski, so they did ski patrols, and then the other three rifle companies did normal search patrols on information provided. We got one group, a chap called Peter Field, got a very good well-earned MC there of in a village where some terrorists, Ayoka terrorists, had base themselves, and they had small underground shelters, and he found one of theirs and exposed it. They retaliated with fire on Peter and his little crew, and he returned the fire and got them, well, wounded them, and got them to tell him where some other people were in the village. He surrounded the house there and got these other suspects. One subsequently became foreign minister, a chap called Polycarpos, when they got independence. But that was a major operation there. Did lots of searches, but they were quite negative. But that was the real highlight of two Paris operations in the mountains.
How did this compare with being in Palestine on internal security?
Well, the main difference I found was that Palestine, it was after the war, where national servicemen didn't want to be there in any case, and they were not 100% keen, whereas two para were a lively bunch. I all wanted to be parachuters, and even in searches and that, they were keen to get at it and not looking over their shoulders so many days to do. They were professional soldiers. I think that was influenced my opinion and the difference between the two. The chaps in the Hampshires, God bless them, you know, had done, a lot of them had served in Austria and places like that, Italy, and wanting to get out. And those that were nearly ending their time wanted to see the end of their days. So there's a big difference there. I'm not saying that dominated, but certainly influenced their attitude.
Did you have more success in Cyprus than in Palestine?
We certainly did, two para. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Where the areas where two para operated, or the para brigade operated, there was little problems. I don't think there's any doubt about that. No. And then we came back after. I spent a year in the UK after we came back, and then I resigned, having married, and decided that I'd had enough soldiering.
How do you feel now about having served with the commandos in the Second World War?
Oh, that's my first love. I mean, that was probably the most important part of my military career. A tremendous camaraderie. And I think it all goes back to the fact that every one of the army commandos was a volunteer, and no one stayed in them unless he wanted to be, and unless the CO wanted him to be. The fear of RTU was a very real one, and there's no doubt in my mind that the commandos were a core elite. And the fact that of the four special service units that survived post-war, that's the Royal Marine Commandos, the SAS, the Special Boat Section, and the Parachute Regiment, are all direct descendants of the 1940 initial commando volunteers. David Stirling, volunteer in July 1914, commandos. Roger Courtney, volunteer, commandos, 1940. Two commando, the original parachutists, who became then the 1st Battalion of Parachute Regiment. All four links of those original 1940 army commandos.
Have you had any after effects of your army service?
Yeah, I've got arthritis, for which I get a small, which they say is probably attributable or accelerated, a spinal injury. parachuting.
What about psychological effects?
No. No. I've had dreams and things like that, but nothing to speak of. And no counselling to date. Apropos after effects, I think my own experiences were those of someone who saw action, quite a bit of it, in different places and different times, but only in short bursts. Raids, for instance, over a matter of hours. Internal security duties, again, under different circumstances. I think I have great respect for those who, say, were in the jungle or in Italy, in the line, for days, not as bad as World War I, but similar, under awful physical conditions, which was compounded by enemy action as well. And then probably having comrades killed around you, but you couldn't move from there because that was your post. And you might have to lie there or stay there with a dead comrade right by you. Whereas in a raid or an action which I was involved in, the dead were left and you cleared out. You didn't have to sit or stay by it. And so I think, I wouldn't say I was fortunate, but there's a different aspect of operational. Short, sharp bursts are quite different to prolonged, sustained action under physical and climatic conditions, which must have been terrible. Looking back, a large part, not a large part, but a considerable part of my commando service was in training period. I mean, at Aknakari, although we had during the whole period, not while I was there, but over its whole lifetime, some 42 deaths through training. And again, I mean, I saw some mangled bodies there and bits and pieces of people blown up by explosives, but it was there and gone. Whereas, as I said earlier, it wasn't sustained endurance of those conditions. And it was all part of training and considered the same as one said about the Dieppe raid. Although there were 4,000 killed, wounded and missing in a few hours, the lessons learnt there seemed to, in the opinion of many, to justify the casualties inflicted.
Do you think that training helps people to cope psychologically?
Yeah, I do, without a shadow of doubt. I do. We had one of the showpieces of Aknakari was the opposed landing, which all hell was let loose on fixed lines with the all sorts of effects. And the firing overhead was too near to be comfortable, but it gave the chaps a taste of it. And, you know, there was no doubt about it, because I've got written testimony of a lot of chaps. Well, one of the survivors of Dieppe, the Free Commando, who had a hell of a time with legendary Peter Young, on the way back to him said to Peter, "Well, it wasn't as bad as Aknakari, was it?" And Roger Courtney, you know, the founder of the SBS, said on more than one occasion that many of his experiences in training were far more frightening than the actual thing.